Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett and I will be your host for this program. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews. A chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is author Jeffrey Friedberg. Jeffrey has just released his first book in an ambitious four-book series. Book one is Black Road 2012, and it is billed as a paranormal thriller. We do have our switchboard open this morning, and if anyone has questions for Jeffrey, you're welcome to call in. The number is area code 646-378-1120. Jeffrey, welcome to the show. It is great to talk to you again.
Thank you, Simon. It's my pleasure.
Maybe we could start with a little background. Who is Jeffrey Avalon Friedberg?
I'm still asking myself that question, but I'm a former licensed private detective. I worked in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania for a long time, and I've also been an internet website kind of guy, and I've done internet marketing and promotion, and I was also what they call an internet consultant at America Online in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I reside.
Avalon is a very unusual name. Is there a story behind it?
Well, Avalon, of course, is where it's the mythical island where the perhaps mythical King Arthur was put to rest after his death, where he sleeps to this moment in a cave waiting to be recalled to defend and save England. So I kind of like that knightly aspect, and I'm using his name with his blessings, I hope.
That's splendid. You've led a pretty interesting life. You said that you were a private investigator, a web guy for a while. What brought you to the art of writing?
Well, it's probably a question of what took me away from the art of writing. I started out in college to become a writer. I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, and I was vectoring in on that, and I got distracted and got out of college and was distracted further. I went to work for a worldwide private detective agency at the time called Globe Detective, which was acquired by Kidda, which was acquired by someone else. Anyway, from there I went on to another more elite secret type of private detective agency, and I worked there for a long time. It was challenging work, very interesting. It occupied my imagination, so that's how I was distracted. My imagination got distracted. Then I went into business for myself for a long time, but all along I'm wanting to be a writer, and I am writing. I'm doing reports. I'm also a filmmaker, just nobody knows I'm making film of them. It's kind of secret. So, I'm writing reports and writing, and I'm learning how to do dictation, which kind of changes your view of information and data and gives you the ability to present it in a certain way. And as I'm doing all of this marvelous detecting work, I'm honing my observational skills, and I'm learning to observe, and I'm listening to people from the shadows as I skulk about, and I learn to hear what people are saying. I learn dialogue, and then I decided I'd had enough of the whole detecting game around 2000-2001. I sold everything, fled Philadelphia for Florida, set up shop down there, and tried to get back into writing things I had been thinking about for 30 years and reading about since I was probably 8, Asimov, Heinlein, all the biggies. And that's a funny thing. Those original storylines, like with Shakespeare, just have never really been improved on. They've been glossed up, shined up, buffed up and messed up, but they've never really been improved on. So these storylines are kind of eternal, mythic, and I got very interested in The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell, studied that, read the book repeatedly many times, and I began to develop a philosophy, political, religious, sociological, and the writing gave me an outlet, and I knew that one day I would thereby be able to force people to listen to me.
That's great. You know, when I'm wearing my other hat, or one of my other hats, which is my journalist hat, I cover quite a number of missing children's cases, and have got involved in several. I would say up to my neck, and one of the groups I deal with are private investigators, and I've come to the conclusion that as a breed, you're all fairly colorful.
Imagine that. That's something that I myself don't really think about it. I have a very good friend who's still in the detecting game in Philly. I talk to him weekly. We review old times, but outside of that, it's not something I think about at all. People ask me, what's your favorite story? And I have to stop and wonder what they're talking about and then delve back and think of something. But I suppose you're right. They are kind of a colorful breed. They're not really restricted in the way a police officer might be or a police detective, although we are regulated by state and county law enforcement officials, pretty closely regulated and investigated, and you really have to be pretty spotless to hold a license and do all this. So it's kind of a faux image, but yeah, it's kind of a, it can be kind of a Sam Spade, Miami Vice type of sensation if you get too deeply into it and you get tunnel vision. You really have to watch yourself and remember what's at stake, which is your freedom, your life, and same for others that you're dealing with. You don't want to have a body count piling up around you.
Yeah, I heard of a fabulous story. I have a really good friend who is a quote bounty hunter, and Discovery Channel decided they wanted to do a demo tape, so they shipped off the film crew to southern Florida, and they went out on their hunt. Now, the deal was they were going to just pull in a guy, you know, revoke his bond. It was late at night. And so there's 13 people with boom mics and all the rest of this nonsense. And a neighbor just happened to be looking out the window. You know, it's like 2 a.m. or something. And calls 911. So they get the felon in question. They have him cuffed. He's in the back of a car. And there's, you know, I don't know, four or five vehicles involved, you know, and everyone's barreling down the road. They come to a right turn in the road. They go round, and there are 20 cop cars waiting for them. Complete SWAT team. They pulled everyone out, including the film crew, threw them on the ground.
Well, nothing focuses you more, Simon, from personal experience, than the racking of a police shotgun.
Oh, yeah.
It really focuses the attention. Now, this thing you're talking about, this was actually an episode on Reno 911. They had the same exact thing, some kind of a bounty hunter, I can't remember his name, but it was hilarious. Yeah, stuff like that happens. I mean, there's no guarantee. I mean, stuff goes wrong, as they say.
Oh, yeah. Well, according to my friend Bill, I mean, this SWAT team was pretty well armed, and they meant business.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. They're very well armed. They're very well trained, and what you have to worry about and what all police and everyone responsible who goes about armed has to worry about is the reflex. Draw, aim, fire. They have to be. They're very professional and they're very careful.
Right. But before we get to the book, could you maybe bring us up to speed on what the significance is of this date, December 21, 2012?
All right. I am no John Major Jenkins, who is my personal recognized expert. He has a book out, The 2012 Story. But the ancient Mayan calendar factually predicts that there will be an alignment of the sun with the center of the Milky Way galaxy on the winter solstice, which will be the winter solstice of 2012, which falls on December 21st at 11:11 a.m. This conjunction, where the sun literally lines up with the center or the core of our galaxy, happens every, I think, 27,500 years. I believe that's the number now. This is not mythology. This is scientific fact. It's not in question. It's going to happen. The sun will indeed align itself with the galactic core after traversing what's called the ecliptic of the zodiac, or a straight line through the zodiac. And when it comes to rest on the dark rift cloud, which is in the center of the Milky Way, that will be the longest night of the year. And in the ancient Mayan myth, the mythology of it, this is the sun god dying and being reborn at dawn from the womb, which is the dark rift cloud of the Milky Way in the ancient Aztec religion. But he will be born from his own wife, who is the goddess. So when the sun finally rises, he is reborn out of death, and the current world age will end. And according to the Mayan book, the Popol Vuh, a new world age will begin. That's said to portend the age that will last another, the beginning of an age that will last another 27,500 years, and this will include famine, terror, and the death of God, according to the mythology. So the mathematics are correct as to the fulfillment of the myth. I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Without giving away any spoilers, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of Black Road 2012?
Yes. Basically, Simon, people may think they want to live forever and never die. It seems like a good idea. But if you really, really examine it, to live forever just isn't human. So Black Road 2012 is a paranormal thriller that I structured around this ancient Mayan doomsday prophecy when this new world age will begin. In Black Road 2012, a young Native American woman and her unborn twins are murdered. This references the Native American myth of the hero twins, who are born and reborn to scourge evil from the earth. And in the Mayan myth, a semblance of this clears the way for their father, the sun god that I just mentioned, to be reborn. And funny thing, the mythology of twins occurs everywhere, in all ages, in all cultures. There are hero twins, Romulus and Remus, for one example. Anyway, this beautiful young Native American woman is murdered savagely and brutally, and her ex-private eye husband, whose name is Jack Vane, finds himself charged with the murders, but he's also become embroiled in the middle, the center of this sinister global conspiracy concerning what this 2012 coming event is really about. Of course, Jack escapes. He's hunted by dark forces from this world and another. They are all hell-bent on using a terrible secret to enslave Earth and all of humanity forever. And in the end, Jack's future and the future of Earth and humanity depends on his choice between his own humanity and godhood. There are many opponents that he meets. He's pursued by, he's especially menaced by an ex-girlfriend who's a police lieutenant. She's in love with him, but she hates him because he dumped her. She's a psycho Barbie type of cop, and she pursues him relentlessly. There are some very, very realistic and lifelike characters that are based on people I've known or people that have popped into my head. And to be frank, I've read this book maybe 5 or 6 times in paperback. I really love it, so I don't know what else to tell you.
So there you have it, folks. The author really loves his book.
I really love the characters. Steven Spielberg had the same, speaks of the same odd experience where you fall in love with the universe you've created and the characters, and you just don't want to leave them.
Right.
So it's good to know I'm not alone.
2012 has become a very popular theme. We had the movie, and actually Black Road 2012 is the second book that I've read recently that uses 2012 as the focal point. William Gladstone has one out called The 12. Although his plot line is very different from yours, there is a commonality between the two books, and that is the Native Indian theme. Is there actually a link between Native Indian teachings and maybe what the Mayans believed?
Well, I was able to find about 20 or 21 books on Native American mythology, religion, black magic, witchcraft, things along these lines. And from what I gather, now it's very difficult to get a knowledgeable Native American to sit down and talk to you about this because they have, I almost said serious reservations. They have great reticence to discuss certain matters revolving around witchcraft or black magic. They will discuss their mythology, but it's not a mythology to them. It's the Bible. It's the creation story, and they don't want to hear that their ancestors were Athabascan Mongoloids who came over from Siberia. No, this is the fourth or the fifth world, depending who you talk to, and Spider Woman and all the rest of the gods and goddesses, Shell Woman, they are real. So it's hard to sit down and talk, but I gather that the ancient Mayans were kind of may have been kind of the Atlantis type, Donovan down under the sea, dispersal, diaspora of various advanced knowledge and religion a long time ago, and may have gotten up as far as the southwest North American continent and spread their ideas and mythology. And yes, there are similarities between southwest Indian, Native American mythology and the ancient Mayan religion, even sometimes down to the very names of gods that are used. But then again, these gods are the same all over the world in all ages, all times, all cultures. They just have different names. You can find, you've got the sun god. So is he first father, or is he Helios, or Apollo, or whoever? The gods, if they exist, know who they are, and they don't really need to be named. So I hope that answers your question, Simon.
Sure. Well, what is your personal view about December 2012? Is it time to head for the hills?
Well, I in fact have I should have an article posted and running in your fantastic site, bloggernews.net, today, and it deals with precisely that. It goes over what people are saying might happen, and it goes over what has happened in the past, and I ask the question, why why is it taking us the way it is now? And the answer is that there's kind of an ingrained encoding in our human DNA and survival instincts for survival, to avoid death. So we pay attention to stuff that can make us dead. We're alert to it. It's in the genes. Now, along with this, in the 2012 coming event is the fear of death, but there's also a desire inborn in the very sweet human soul, a desire for improvement, a desire for connection with the eternal, a desire for something better than we are and much grander than ourselves, a reason for living and a reason for dying, and what does it all mean? So in this 2012 event or mythology,
as I see it, you have two things going on in the human
psyche. You have fear and desire. As to what the desire would be for improvement or change or a new beginning or renewal. As far as what do I believe personally, I think something might happen. Something will happen. I don't know what. I'm a good detective. I'm patient. And when I don't know, I wait and see what happens. That's the essence of observation.
We've basically been concentrating on 2012, but Black Road contains lots and lots of other elements. I mean, it's a whole potpourri of conspiracy theories. Are you yourself a conspiracy theorist?
Well, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's real, and it's not paranoia if they're really doing it to you. To answer your question, no, I wouldn't call myself a conspiracy theorist. I'm a professional investigator with something like 35 years experience at the highest levels of private investigation. I mean, people paid me to do it. They paid me a lot, so I must have been doing a good job. So this book really started out as an investigation. I was paying attention to the news. I'm a news junkie, and just nothing made sense. Nothing made sense. And the news is full of conspiracies and conspiracy theories and UFOs and Nazi gold and Nazi super weapons and aliens and Roswell and Area 51, assassinations of presidents and so on. So I decided to go back. Well, I decided on a very simple thing. I would go back the beginning of recorded history and figure out what was going on. It'd be a piece of cake, okay? It'd be a piece of cake. I was in Florida. I had a three-car garage. I air-conditioned it, and I started researching it in there. And I mentioned it was a three-car garage because I literally covered the walls and the garage doors with 3x5 cards and a fanfold computer printout as I researched everything imaginable from the dawn of human history and before that, up until the present. I put out all of my key events that I was interested in that represented chaos or order or progressions, Roman Empire, the Inca Empire, assassination of JFK, what have you. The melting of the glaciers. Once I had everything nicely up and decorated, I just walked around and read everything for about 3 weeks, and then it came to me what it all meant to me as the investigator. And I sat down, and I've probably done a year and a half of research. I've been working on this four book project since about 2003, maybe.
There goes
the alert watchdog, if you can hear that. But
is that a hot air balloon going over?
That could be a hot air balloon. She's death on the hot air balloons because they have this terrible dragon breath
breathing thing that they do when they
inflate the gas balloon, the gas envelope, rather. But anyway, I should let listeners know about that reference.
I was talking to Jeffrey yesterday. He actually sent me a photograph And apparently his dog just has this absolute hate for hot air balloons. And there happened to be a hot air balloon going over the house. And the dog was going crazy.
When they inflate the bag, then when they blow out the hot air, it's kind of like, if you can hear that, and it sounds literally like a dragon. I have an ex-cop lives across the street. He was out picking up the paper one morning in his, no, he was on the balcony, rather, in one morning, taking in the breeze in his underwear in the peace and quiet of a New Mexico dawn, and he hears this terrible dragon breath, and he looks up, and there's a hot air balloon with 12 passengers about 50 feet overhead looking down at him in his underwear as they sail across Albuquerque on the morning breeze. You have to watch out for them. They're like pigeons here. They're everywhere. But anyway, I did my research. I'm going to answer your question. I did my research, and I did begin with all of these conspiracies. I cover everything from what actually and truly happened at Roswell, because I know for a fact what happened. What happened there, the result of that, and everything about your basic Nazi super weapons and your basic Nazi gold bars and worldwide global conspiracies and shadow governments and aliens. I mean, I've got it all, Simon. Not only that, but it all works. I mean, it's not just a mishmash. It's all, I think, very dramatic and very realistic to me. And I think what drives it is the characters. Once you create that universe or a universe as an author, and you create a character and you set them down inside of the universe, they're metaphors. They can only do certain things that they're programmed to do. So I don't have to know what Jack Thane will say in a situation. He already knows, and he writes the scene himself. And because I've based so many of these characters on real people, loosely, or I've given them their own basic personality in their universe, they know what to do. And as a result, because I have been a student of human nature and a professional observer all my life, these characters are very real. They come across as very real and genuine to me. So that holds all of these conspiracies together in what I think is a logical and mature manner.
You have a rather intriguing explanation for the Roswell incident. And while I'm not sure I buy into it 100%, it certainly makes a lot of sense that it wasn't aliens, it was people. It might just be the fact that they were involved in some kind of conflagration, and the flight suits they were wearing had essentially melted and molded.
I don't mention it in the book, but if you look up, we're talking about the Nazi long-range twin-jet fighter bomber, the Horten GO-29, I think, I can't remember the number, but it was the Horten. It was a swept-wing, bat-like plane, I don't know, 50, 60 years ahead of its time. It was nearly a Mach 1 jet. It was radar invisible. It didn't show up on radar. It had a memory metal built into its skin that you could deform and it would resume its shape. And it was real. It flew. But if you go to Kenneth Arnold's description of the first quote-unquote flying saucers that he saw piloting his small airplane over, I believe it was Mount Rainier back in, I believe, 1946-47. If you look at those illustrations, they look exactly like the Horten GO-29. So I think this is what we're dealing with, that this is what the U.S. government was involved with, and I explain in the book, I don't want to give it away too much, I explain in the book why and how this could have been allowed to happen. But I really believe if there was a crash at Roswell, and it may have only been a weather balloon, I don't know, but I don't think it was. If there was a crash at Roswell, I think that's probably what crashed there. And I'm speaking as a professional investigator. I mean, I went back through everything. I had charts and graphs. I believe I even know why the U.S. Army, the general down there, let out at first, we've captured a flying disc, and then the headline the next day, I think, was Army drains saucer when they denied that they had captured a flying disc. I think I know how that screw-up happened. If I look at the timing, I found certain generals who should have been in Elmendorf, Alaska, on the air base there, are suddenly in Roswell. And other important people who should have been someplace else are suddenly in Roswell. And how whatever the wreckage was shipped to, I forget where, the air base in Ohio, where this, at that time, that's where you took secret things. Now, the air base outside of Roswell, this was the Area 51 of its time. This was the only place where they had the, I believe, the B, well, I can't remember the designation. It was the only long-range pressurized bomber in the world capable of delivering atomic bombs and returning to base, and it was the only place in the world that had the atomic bombs. So you've got advanced Buck Rogers Star Trek super weapons on this airbase outside of Roswell, and you have this crash a couple miles away, and I've just kind of tied it all together as to what I think it probably means. I'll tell you something funny. As I was researching this, you know, I have my characters in my book, Miss Jones, Mr. Green, Mr. White, Mr. Smith.
Yes.
When I was researching this, I got calls back from people like that, from the FAA, the Air Force, the Mr. Green, Mr. White, Mr. Smith, Mr. Jones. So that really prompted my thinking, Simon. So the more I got into this, the stranger things started to happen, and the more I started to think I was on the right track. Anyway, you can read about it.
Before I forget, I know people are going to want to rush out and buy copies of Black Road 2012. Do you have a website, and do you have a preferred retail link that people could go to?
Thank you, Simon. It's available on Amazon at goodoldamazon.com. If you put in Black Road 2012 or my name, Jeffrey Friedberg, it should pop up, and there are, I swear there were 10 five-star reviews there. There's another review. It's a four-star review. The guy hated the genre, but he read the book, and he pronounced it a thriller that walked the walk and talked the talk and walked the walk, and he was not disappointed, and he liked it even though he hated the genre. He was my four-star. But it's available at Amazon under Black Road 2012 or under Jeffrey Friedberg, Friedberg.
And do you have a website as well for the book?
Yes, I do. It's called What's, WHATS, hyphen, or dash, thebigidea.com. What's-thebigidea.com.
Obviously, you're getting some pretty positive reader feedback.
Yes, people seem to love the book. And when I wrote this, I wrote it to be a movie, frankly. I made it, it's a movie in my head. When I want to write a scene, I don't know any other way. I visualize it and I play it. So I wrote it the way I play it. And almost everybody says the same thing. I felt like I was there. It was a roller coaster ride of thrills and chills. You see it. I couldn't put the book down. Almost everybody says the same thing, which is very pleasing to me as an author, because as an author, a writer, it's my job to bring your mind to a point congruent with what I see. It's magical, if you think about it.
I could actually see this transitioning very well to the silver screen. Have you explored that possibility?
I've looked into it a little bit. I'm not going to sit here and say, yeah, it's going to be a movie one day, but I think it would make a... I wrote it as a movie. I wrote it as a screenplay to double-check myself. That I wrote it as a book, and in my head it's a movie, and it would be easily transitioned to the screen. It could actually be made right here in Tamalewood, which is New Mexico, it's the new Hollywood of the Southwest. It's set here in the Southwest, which is very mystical, spooky locations. If you've ever seen any ancient black and white movies about giant ants or giant grasshoppers or aliens, I mean, it's always here in good old New Mexico, which they call the land of enchantment. That's just the land of spookiness here. So the whole thing could be shot here. I've used locales from Albuquerque itself, real places. I've changed the names. I've mapped out the chase scenes. I mapped out the big scene that takes place at the outdoor mall. Some of the other places were actually real places that I visited.
I talked to many first-time authors. In fact, over 90% of the books I read are from people new to the field. And I'll share a secret with you. I like it that way. I wouldn't dream of reading a Clancy or any of the other book machines. In my mind, they're just robots. They churn out the same drivel year after year. But a new author faces some real challenges. Finding a damn publisher. You opted to self-publish. Did you try the traditional route first?
No, I have a marketing plan, which I'll share in case there's any other ambitious new writers out there. My marketing plan, it's not for everybody, was to first self-publish and sell a few thousand books, or sell as many books as I could, and get my references and get my reviews and make my bones, as they say in Philadelphia, South Philly. And then I take that, and when I write my begging and pleading letter to the agents, literary agents, there's a question that you have to answer. They always ask you, well, what have you written? And my answer is nothing. Where were you published before? My answer is nowhere. And, of course, that goes into the circular file. But if I can show them, yes, I've sold X books on Amazon, here's my reviews, and so on, then I've got a little bit of a credential to work with. And from there, you try and find a literary agent who tries to find you a publisher, a main, big, maybe New York house publisher, who will buy your property from you. So I have 4 books to be sold in a package, which is a marketing thing as well as my ambition and my dream. And from there, one would hope that one has done a good enough job in imagery, and this is everything to the writer, in imagery and story, and attracting the reader into the story and making he or she part of the story, that someone would see this possibility as a film and put it up as the ultimate myth, the ultimate dream, on the silver screen of the movies. That would be the ultimate thrill for any artist, to see his work, his painting, displayed that way.
Let's talk about book 2 for a second. Does it have a title yet?
Yeah, I call it Unholy Grail.
Unholy Grail, I like that. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, after you've read book 1, which covers this ancient Sumerian artifact, which is an evil artifact, which is being pursued through time by a great heroic soul who wishes to destroy it, counter its evil effect. Book 2 takes you back to the origins, where this thing comes from, and it opens with a tremendously dramatic, I think, scene in a pagan cavern buried deep under the Temple of Solomon under Mount Moriah, 950 B.C., where we see that this ancient Sumerian bowl is going to be used to conjure and bring through an evil entity, et cetera, et cetera. So it may sound like the standard evil entity coming through the portal story, but it's not, because I give all ages and all cultures and all parts of history the same characteristics as you can find on the front pages of any newspaper today. These are the same people, the same politicians, the same movers and shakers then that we have today. So I make these people human. They don't move in slow motion like Moses or speak like they're reading Shakespeare. They swear, they curse, they moan, they groan, they bitch, they complain. They're real people.
I'm going to play devil's advocate just for a second. You're very intent that this Sumerian artifact is inherently evil. Yet you allude to in the book, you allude to the fact that it could be used for good.
Well, you cannot have. This is for the benefit of the characters. You cannot have a totally evil character who's just evil and wants to chop things up and kill people. I mean, you can do that to the extreme, then you have a Freddy or you have a Michael Myers. But that's not what I'm writing. But when you're an author and you're trying to create a story, you have to have characters. You need a lead character. You need your opponents, at least three or four opponents, and you play them all off of each other. But as in real life, and these are real people in a real universe in my book. These people have to believe in what they're doing, and they have to believe that by their lights, they're doing the right thing. So, yes, the characters that possess this mysterious ancient Sumerian lost science, which is what it is, it's a lost science where science and religion blend and become almost magical. You have people who believe in what they're doing. You might have somebody who does want to use the bowl for good, provide clean energy to the world and end starvation, and she believes in what she's doing and saying. But then you have somebody else who wants to make himself the god. All right, but then why does he want to be the god? He too has ambitions and aspirations. He too wants to do things for the earth, but it's what he believes. This is kind of a little rule.
Are you saying that humanity is inherently bad? If you give someone essentially unlimited power, they will eventually use it for a dark reason?
No, and I'm so glad you asked this question, because humanity is born being human. I believe, in my private philosophy, that humanity is born knowing what it is to be human, knowing how to act as a human being, and knowing where that eternal connection is or was that everyone feels is out there greater than themselves. You're born knowing this, but you forget it. You've forgotten it, that your aboriginal societies and religions, such as the Native Americans or the aboriginal Hebrews, prehistoric Hebrews, were your Neanderthal, your Cro-Magnon man, these people were actually much closer to the answers. They were much closer to their problems, and problems need answers. So I believe humanity is basically good. I believe it can be misled, it can be lost. I believe it's sometimes diverted by politicians, by government, by religion, whoever your particular bugaboo happens to be, choose that. So it can be misled, and I believe that there are, where you have one force, there has to be an opposing force, action, reaction. So if you have a force for good, whatever that might be, magnetic waves, gravity, light, photons, you're also going to have a force in the opposite direction, whatever that might be, weather, I don't know, x-rays, take your pick. Gods or demons, you have your choice.
My producer is whining in my ear. We are about 30 seconds from going off air. Jeffrey, I really, really want to thank you for taking time to talk to me this morning. And I'm sure I speak for everyone at Blogger News Network in wishing you great success with Black Road 2012, and I'm looking forward to the next three books.
I am too, Simon. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it, too. I'm halfway through book two physically, and if there are any new writers out there who are interested, my website does contain lots and lots of tips on writing, free tips for the writer. What's-thebigidea.com.
This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a great day, and I'm sure we will all be talking again soon. Till next time, goodbye.